My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another week of FedWatch. My name is Ansel Lindner, and I'm here with my co-host, Nolan Bowerly, Count BTC. How are you doing today?
I love life, Ansel. Who could complain?
We got a big show today. Bitcoin, of course. We're going to talk about the price finally moving a little bit, finally budging. Then we got big numbers, GDP numbers out of Japan and estimates out of the U.S. So where is this recession that everyone's talking about? You know, it just looks like GDP is accelerating. Of course, China, though, is having big problems, so we're going to just discuss some of that. And then we're going to look at charts of the dollar, commodities, and see if we can find if there is any recession coming, if there is any acceleration maybe, you know, more inflation coming down the road. We're going to see what we can learn from the commodities charts. So that's what we have in store for you guys today. Make sure you to like, comment, subscribe wherever you're watching this. And Nolan, anything to add up front here?
No, just, you know, I got to say, it's the dog days of summer, so it's not a summer camp version of our production today. We've got our super helpful, talented Chris back in studio. So,
producer Chris.
Yeah, this is not being brought to you by our best intentions. It's actually being brought to you with some professional capacity today. But it's the summer, so the news is boring. But not really, because everything's happening at once. So we're going to talk about it today, right? So it's not so, it looks like everything's about to happen. We got the BRICS thing coming up at the end of the summer. So I like to frame everything in with that BRICS meeting, as well as the Fed meeting at the very end of the summer. So it's all going to be happening in the same couple of days. So this is sort of the calm before the storm, as I like to think about it.
Absolutely. Things are starting to turn around as we enter Q3. So the Q3 milestone for me is very, very important. The seasonal ebbs and flows of the economy, end of Q3, tends to be where a lot of action happens. So we're getting closer and closer to that. All right, let's dive into the Bitcoin charts, because we actually are getting some action here, falling out of this triangle pattern. I do not like to see this. I also put on here this red line for September 1st deadline for all of these ETFs. Of course, this isn't the ultimate deadline. This is just the next kind of milestone on their path. But a lot of the ETF experts that I've been listening to, they say if the ETF, like the BlackRock ETF or any of them, get delayed even once, it cuts their chance of ever being approved. So I think this is a very big day, and I thought this was going to be the date of the breakout here of this pattern to the upside, but it looks like we're having a breakout to the downside. Any thoughts on the price and how this affects your kind of view of the chance of these ETFs getting approved?
I don't know if this relates to the chances of the ETF so much. Again, I think we're dealing with people a little constrained anyway in terms of just purchasing power for Bitcoin. So I think it's a little bit of the same story, but this is exactly the scenario you were talking about last week. So we're still on script as far as what you've been talking about. And it looks like critically this support level is broken. So there's not as many options from here out because of that is what I would understand. I mean, everything's possible, but this starts limiting the likely scenarios.
Yeah, well, I thought this we were going to get down to around this price a week ago, and mm-hmm. it being here now, you can see it breaks out of that pattern. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people poo-poo on TA, and a lot of people watching probably just think, oh, you're going to change the line when it breaks the line. And I did. That's the next slide. Mm-hmm. But TA is just a collection of shelling points on the mm-hmm. screen. And so what is going to grab people's attention? You know, those marginal buyers out there that do set the price, what mm-hmm. are they watching? What is going to make them come in and buy? And this is not good because it tells me that there is just not enough demand right now, which doesn't make any sense because we have this ETF coming. So I think my mind of price as an economist and thinking about prices and stuff, and that the market is way smarter than we are. This tells me that most likely it's going to be delayed. And if that is delayed, it cuts down the likelihood of it getting approved. If we're going down that narrative road, I mean, it starts looking bleak, in my opinion, at least for the next 6 months for the Bitcoin price. Any comments on that, Nolan?
No, I can see that scenario. I can see exactly what you're saying, right? We have no choice but to look at things in terms of momentum and exuberance. And of course, Bitcoin is a psychological commodity. So the amount of people that are paying attention and literally how popular it is at any one time is really important. Bitcoin ought to be a dead simple thing. And when it does become popular, you know, it's everybody who likes it. So what I can see here is the other scenario that we've been talking about, that we just go sideways. We get back into the 29K gang and the 28K gang is going to start forming. And then we sort of go sideways until we really get those fireworks. And those fireworks might have to be until 2024, where I continue to predict that given the political climate, Bitcoin is going to be front and center throughout 2024 and is going to not lack from popularity. Right now, it looks like what we've seen many times in the history of Bitcoin, it's boring. Right. Things get boring sometimes in Bitcoin, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But the financial engineers who are looking for the new big thing to sell will likely have inventory to move in 2024.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to that next slide where I did end up changing the line. this is because the first chart was on logarithmic scale. Mm-hmm. And this one is just on straight scale. And so you can see what it does to that line. It actually makes it so we are approaching that line, but from a different scale. I hope that makes sense to people out there. But yeah, so we still have a chance to kind of save this pattern as we approach this September 1st. I know I wrote on my newsletter that I thought at the time, this last Monday, that the chance of something happening on September 1st, like an approval, was above 50%, but now it's starting to look like that's not the case. So mm-hmm. any thoughts on me changing the scale here?
No, I think this is actually, to me anyway, the more accurate scale. The other one, while easy to compute visually, this seems like the most straight way of seeing it. So To me, that still fits the narrative that I'm seeing out in the space, right? Mm-hmm. I see a distracted DC. I see a DC that is not really I'm coalescing around any sort of predictable behavior. And Bitcoin caught in the mix of that for now seems on script and on brand. And that's kind of what I see coming out of these numbers. I continue to see Wall Street a little bit tiptoeing, doing a bit of a two-step around things. But it's one of those things that it can happen really quick because it's a herd mentality thing. And I continue to look to 2024. 2023 still feels like that sort of boring sideways time frame.
We're simmering right now. We're simmering.
Been here before. Done. Seen this before.
All right, let's go to the next one. This is a weekly chart. And I put some important dates in the future. Chris, if you could take off our heads there, they can see these dates a little bit better. Thank you. The end of Q3, which everybody knows by now, I'm very big into the seasonality thing. That's coming up. End of year I put on here, and then a TBD for the halving right around when that's expected. So, you know, we're running out of time. If we want to get moving and have the cycles rhyme with history, if we break down here, I think it puts a lot of the cycle comparisons in jeopardy of totally being on the wrong side. So any thoughts on that?
Well, look, to be honest, every one of these cycles has been a little bit different. And I'm not a big, you know, it's easy to think about history in terms of it rhymes and all that, but it's of course never true, right? Things that are brand new and have never happened before happen new each and every time. The last crash, the last bull market was preceded by a huge COVID crash right before. We've never seen that before, right? We've never seen, you know, that kind of a crash right before a halving. So each one of them is a little different, but the overall feeling is the same, sort of boring. And then the whole world has to pay attention because it's somehow critical for XYZ to work. Mm-hmm. And I continue to look at political dysfunction, which we're going to be talking about again later. And looking at the market and how they're reacting to all of that. And of course, we continue to think of Wall Street as not really sentimental. They just want to pick the winner and make money off of it, right? And you can see that option being right there. So it doesn't really require that every domino hits with perfect style in a perfect place for 2024 to still be set up. It looks like we've got viable presidential candidates talking about backing the US dollar with Bitcoin. It looks like we have foreign countries and a demand for US debt that's just, you know, falling like a rock. And so you have this huge void all of a sudden of where this kind of allocation goes, right? And so Bitcoin is sort of moseying into center stage as far as I can tell, right?
Yeah. Well, you brought up a lot of good points there. Were you referring to Javier Milei down there in Argentina?
Yeah, that's a pretty neat one too, isn't it? I was referring, of course, to RFK for the 2024 election. But indeed, what we see in Argentina this week is pretty enthusiastic. I mean, we've got a guy who's not even sitting around arguing for why Bitcoin is better than fiat banking. You know, he had a great line that the government or the press asked him when he won his first tour. So he won the first tour. He's got to run into another one in order to become the president, but he won the first tour. So I don't know enough about Argentina to tell you if he's going to win. I've seen it many times where a candidate wins the first tour of these two election systems and then doesn't win the final one because people gang up and et cetera. So I don't know what coalition could beat him or what his chances of winning are. But when I asked him about his plans to destroy their own central bank, they wanted like some, you know, complicated justification and explanation of what he's going to replace it with. And his answer was, they're useless. If we get more of that, we're going to be winning.
Yeah, I saw him hitting the central bank pinata and going nuts, not just like breaking it, but going nuts after it. And he's a big Bitcoiner. There's stuff about him in interviews describing like how money evolves, you know, how the market picks money and Bitcoin being a return to private sector money. He's a great candidate. And man, that could catch fire. I hope it does. Mm-hmm. And we see this all over. Like you said, the US has politicians, the populist type of politicians that are going to be saying very similar things about Bitcoin. So crazy. It's pretty awesome. All right. Anything else to add about the Bitcoin price? We have a lot of other topics to get to here.
No, I'm anxious to get into all this Japan and GDP numbers from America. And we love our, you know, it used to be that people took these numbers seriously. And we laughed at these peasant countries that had fake numbers.
Yeah.
You know, remember that? And we used to be like, oh, look at the fake numbers from China, which are obviously still fake. They came out with their numbers. We're going to talk about them this week. But they're directionally true in that they're way lower than what they'd been used to. So
if they report them, because they stopped reporting the youth unemployment rate.
Yeah, I saw that. No more youth unemployment, which used to be like the number one thing.
Yeah, it's at record highs. Okay, but before we get to China, that's going to be at the end of today's show. Right now, let's jump into Japan. So if we could get slide number four up, Chris, please. This came out, the June numbers, so April through June. They do their GDP calculations monthly, where we don't really come out with anything except on the quarters. So here you can see trade drives a jump in Japan's GDP in the second quarter to 6%. If you go to the next slide, what I did was I blew up that chart. Dashed line is exports, which we're going to cover here. This is the main number in these numbers is the net exports, though. This isn't like exports surged, okay? It's the net exports that surged. So if we go to the next slide, we'll read a little bit, an excerpt from this Haver Analytics piece. Japan's GDP in second quarter of 2023 jumped to a 6% annual rate after gaining 3.7% in the first quarter. These two growth rates are a sharp breakout from the 2022 fourth quarter of 0.2% and the third quarter of negative 1.2%. However, on close inspection of the numbers, there's not much in this GDP report that is terribly impressive about the performance of the domestic economy, nor does the domestic economy seem to be a source of inflation pressures. Yes, sir. What's up?
Can I try and translate this?
Go ahead. Yeah.
They're selling their exports for more money.
No.
No?
Surprisingly, no. It's the imports that are dropping. So net exports are looking better. If we go to the next slide, but that is a very good guess. The next slide here, I highlighted the important part of this article. So exports grew at 13% annualized rate. That's true, but they fell 14% last quarter. So they're just about even quarter to quarter. Mm-hmm. However, imports fell at 16% annualized rate after an 8% annualized rate last quarter. So imports continue to fall faster than exports. So the way that GDP calculates it is net exports. And so net exports are making it look like Japan's GDP is, really spiking, but it's not. It's just the calculus of the way GDP works is making it look that way. Okay. So any thoughts on that?
Curious about what it could be in terms of imports that they're not conducting. That would cause this. I'm just like, what sector is it affecting? Is it something to do with automobiles? Is it something to do with food? I know they're very prejudicial about importing food as well as automobiles. I mean, pretty much every car in Japan is made in Japan, right?
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of Fords running around. They have them, but they're not that common.
It'll be consumer demand is down, but also, like if you look out, new orders are falling off. This is the same thing we see in China as well. New order, they're just nobody's ordering anything 6 months, a year out. And so we can have these imports continuing to fall, which are the inputs to the exports, right? And so the exports can continue kind of being flat for a little while until the crash hits and the low demand actually gets priced in. So
is that what you're seeing when you look in this? Are you seeing that same narrative that we just mentioned about Wall Street, yes, you know, sort of holding its breath for clear signs of what to do next, and that everyone collectively is sort of sitting here? Like what you're painting a picture of is a Chinese industry here saying, you know what, let's just be lean this year. Let's not order XYZ. Let's just keep all our powder dry and ready to adapt to whatever this unknown we're heading into is.
Yeah, and it's not just Chinese that are not ordering. Mm-hmm. It's Americans that are not ordering. It's the Europeans not ordering. So, yeah, they're having a – it just hasn't quite caught up. A lot of people want transitory to be like 6 months, but most of these things take 2 years minimum to work through. And what we're seeing right now is the beginning of this process where it makes GDP look good for a little while, for a couple quarters, and then we're going to start it seeing priced in. If we go to the next slide, this is from Jeff Schneider. We've interviewed him on FedWatch here before, but he breaks down all these components, and you can see the net exports was greater than the GDP increase itself. So if you take everything else, or if you take imports and exports out, it was actually a negative GDP quarter for Japan. So this is... I saw all the headlines when this came out. Oh my God, what's going on? Japan is booming. And no, it's not. This is just an artifact of the way that they do the numbers. So are you ready for US GDP, or you got something else on Japan here?
No, that's it's so many systems are breaking down before our eyes, and it shouldn't be any surprise that the typical way of calculating GDP is also breaking down, you know?
Yeah, it's not meant... Like a lot of these calculations, they're meant for relatively steady economies. They don't deal with big shifts very easily. And you saw that during COVID, right, with the unemployment numbers and the GDP numbers during COVID. I mean, it's like negative 15% and then positive 15%.
Yeah.
I mean, does that really make sense? How is there not some smoothing to this? But yeah, so let's get to US GDP numbers. The next slide is... from the Atlanta Fed. This is just one of many, though, and we're going to take a look at that. Chris, if we get the next slide. Thank you. So this is, you can see the green line on top is the Atlanta Fed estimate for Q3. We just got into Q3, though. So, we're about a month. Aren't we halfway through it? We're halfway through already, but we still have 6 weeks to go maybe this estimate will come down. But right now, it's also at roughly 6%. If we go to the next slide, and this is where I thought it was interesting. So this one website called capitalspeculator.com, they had this cool report. So all of these different colors are different estimates of Q3 GDP. All right. And that red bar in the middle is the average. So just because the Atlanta Fed is saying they expect 5.8% and a couple others here, let's see, what's the green one? CNBC is saying, about close to 4% or something. The average is right there at 2. So I thought that was very interesting. Is this the only thing I have for U.S.? Yeah, that was it for U.S. GDP.
No, you got the GDP with yields too.
GDP with yields. Okay. So this is the 10-year. So one thing that I believe in the interest rate fallacy, where interest rates actually go up as the economy is good, because you have more people wanting to borrow, you have more competition for loans, people are able to afford a higher interest rate. And so you have rates going higher. When rates are going down, that actually means that money is tight, that banks don't want to lend and people are tightening their belts. So rates go down. But what we've seen recently here is the 10-year especially is really going vertical almost here. A weekly chart. So last 2 weeks, it's surprised the hell out of me that it's going right back up to near cycle highs, pretty much right at cycle highs. And that tells me that the GDP number is probably actually correct, because that means business is good. Things are booming. And so you have to, so the rates rise. If you go to the next slide, this is one that CK really liked. And this is the rainbow kind of all the different or several different like lengths, durations with the Fed funds rate in red there. And you can see the 10-year is really catching up. It's really going up. It's really a flattening of an inversion, because it's going back closer to zero. But people call this a steepening. When the longer rates go higher relative to shorter rates. But we don't see this very often, where it's actually the long-term rates are going up to catch up with the short-term rates. Usually in a recession, we see the short-term rates come down below the long-term rates. So we would see on this chart, the 3 month and the 2 year falling, not the 10 year going up. So there is a few things here that are telling me that maybe the economy is booming. Maybe GDP is correct here, but go ahead.
You know, yeah, I do my morning show every day at 8 a.m. And of course I spare no quarter to Democrats and Biden and all these people. And we talk about how terrible they are and all that stuff. But I will say, right, that it looks like a lot of the economy. Now, it doesn't mean they're the people you want to see doing well in the economy. It's like pharmaceutical companies and, you know, doesn't mean you want to see these guys doing great. I see a lot of the general consumer sector struggling, right, which is most people's reference of the economy. Mm-hmm. But it looks like a lot of U.S. industry is doing just great. And, you know, I can see from a corporate expenditure point of view that enthusiasm isn't held along. But that's the reason why it stands out to me, because it looks like some stuff is getting done. And there's general progress happening in the economy.
Yeah, and there's a lot of inflow of capital as well. I saw that there was not a record, but it was, I think, maybe an 8-year high or something for a weekly inflow of foreign capital into our stock market. So there's a lot of capital coming in.
Well, I've been predicting that for a long time. I've been sort of saying to everyone that all of their, in foreign countries, all of their stimulus checks and everything had found their way into the U.S. stock market and into the American system, and that it was a form of like a robbery that hadn't been seen in a long time from even a geopolitical point of view, because of course Europeans don't have retail access to a lot of investment buying stock and all these Robin Hood things. So watching all of that business come to America over the past few years, I think this is part of the same scenario where the most of the other systems are so unbelievably incredulous that the U.S. system, which we laugh about and make fun of, is the best amongst them.
Which I think cleanest, bodes dirty really well.
It bodes really well for us Bitcoiners.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so these rates are looking like maybe the GDP numbers are correct, even though there's this import-export type of nuance there to the numbers. But what are commodities saying? Because commodities are forward-looking, right? They actually are, like Dr. Copper, they're a leading indicator. They're not a lagging indicator for global demand. I mean, if you're going to start increasing production because the economy is good, you're going to see it first in those commodity prices, you know, the first inputs. So let's go to slide number 15, please, Chris. It's a little bit, there we go. Thank you. So this is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, and it's a long-term time frame. So you can see on the spike on the left, that's a great financial crisis. The spike on the right is COVID. And so you can see we didn't even get back to the GFC highs, which is interesting. We are below the high, the kind of range from 2010 through 2014, and we're hitting this 50-week moving average and bouncing down. So commodities aren't particularly elevated. They're actually coming off of a downtrend over the last few months. If we go to the next slide, and Nolan, stop me whenever you want.
Yeah, for this one here, what I see is, you know, that that first drop in the green bar, the commodity price bar, right? That looks like basically the invention of American shale that we're talking about, right?
Which one? In Great Financial Crisis?
Yeah. No, Great Financial Crisis. And then we experienced a peak in commodity prices after that, right? Mm-hmm. There was oil, all that stuff became really expensive relative, right? That was when America was starting to see those $5 a gallon, $6 a gallon of gas at the time, which had never been seen before, right? That was a huge surprise in America. I remember it being like, oh my God, right? How could someone win a presidential election $6 a gallon? And the answer to that, of course, was American shale coming in and the innovation that took part in fracking and all of that stuff, changing the entire cocktail around pricing commodities in America, becoming a net exporter from that point on. So is that partly at play here. It's not just policy. It's also just productivity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like more, as you know, as we go forward in time, technology will improve. One thing with shale is, you know, we always knew that there was shale oil there. Mm. We just couldn't get at it, you know, until they invented a cheaper way to do the horizontal drilling. So, definitely the technology has gotten better and getting at the oil has gotten relatively cheaper. I think break even for shale, I hear all sorts of different stories, but from the experts that I follow, break even for shale is about $40 a barrel. So when people say, oh, at seven, it's not profitable at 70, that's not true. The thing that's stopping shale production, I would say, is the land or the leases, mm-hmm. the restriction on leases, restriction on some pipeline stuff. That's what's kind of limiting that. But overall, yeah, I would say that the shale revolution did push down global commodity prices.
So, you know, when you see, like, you know, because the story you're saying here is that good times bring in commodity price booms.
Yeah.
Unless innovation can alter that.
Yes. And I would say that those type of big changes, like the technology changes, they come much less often, you mm-hmm. know? So you might like this, that's one of the biggest geopolitical events of the last 50 years was the shale mm-hmm. thing. So, but we get, you know, 10-year business cycles. So in these business cycles, you'll see maybe 5, 6, 7 business cycles before some sort of big breakout technology that changes the name of the game. But that's definitely shale did that. Yeah. Okay. I hope I answered the question. Next slide is oil. And I highlighted the OPEC supply cuts. They've threatened another one, but we haven't seen that come through. The October of the 2 million barrels was supposed to end, I think, in beginning of July, but that has been extended. So there's still about 4.6 million barrels under their, COVID amount that they were producing back in COVID. So, but oil hit a recent peak and is back down. If we go to the next slide, this is gasoline futures in the U.S. And you can see that big gap down just yesterday. I mean, this was a huge change in the market. Something kind of snapped, and there was a massive gap down yesterday in gasoline futures. So commodities aren't really showing us, at least the energy commodities here with gasoline and oil, there is no boom in the economy that we're seeing. If we go to the next slide, now we're getting into some more commodities. This is copper, and copper is definitely a leading indicator for global economic activity, and it's been on a recent downtrend. Really, it hasn't done anything over the last year. Definitely not showing any increase in demand right here for copper. Kind of, I would say it's slightly leaning down over the last couple of years versus going up. Next slide is aluminum futures. You can see this also is heading down. It's not accelerating upwards like we would see if the economy was really starting to take off. Next slide is wheat. I just wanted to cover one agricultural commodity. And we've heard a lot about wheat exports out of Ukraine and Russia and the end of the grain deal they had over there. There's also been during this week, the Russians blew up some grain silos over there near Odessa or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it really hasn't affected the price of wheat. It doesn't look like people are bidding this up in any way, shape, or form. So overall, commodities are not telling us that we are accelerating in the economy. Did I build a good case here, Nolan? Or what?
You absolutely did, Ansel. I mean, the case you're building to me, if I can try and repeat it, just to to show, you know, connectivity, is that something's going on. There's a collective breath being held. There are certain signs of economic activity that are very positive, hiding what a lot of people think is reason to be enthusiastic. Yet there are pieces that are breaking that don't explain or can't be explained. And that don't allow us to paint a certain picture about what's coming. Close. Good.
Yeah, that sounded good.
I think so.
I also want to push back on this inflation narrative. Like a lot of people are saying that inflation is going to pick back up, or CPI rate, I guess the rate that prices are rising, is going to go back up. But that is coupled with growth. You know, you need growth to sustain these higher prices. And if we don't have growth, which we don't see that in the commodities, these GDP numbers, they have to be just artifacts of the calculations. So that's my, I guess, my main point there.
But that's you know, why we love Bitcoin so much, because, you know, a lot of my predictions about Bitcoin are simply that it's going to be used as the measurement tool to make sense of things like the economy, which are living with these artifacts, these expert opinions, you know, look at what happened with, you know, so by being able to break it down and showing that it isn't even an accurate gauge into what's happening anymore, is really vital. We got to track how this thing's breaking, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a neutral measuring stick. I think CK said that. He quoted you a few times here on the show by saying that neutral measuring stick. That's why it's count BTC, right?
Because you got it. You got to count everything in Bitcoin. Right. Everything. Everything can be counted in Bitcoin.
Absolutely. Okay. Next story up is the China crisis. The China crisis. We're blowing through these pretty quick. But the China crisis, if we go to the next slide of slide 21, this actually inverted from what I usually show. Usually I show the CNY as it gets weaker. It's actually falling against the dollar on the chart, but this way, this chart is going higher, that means the yuan is getting weaker. You can see it did break out here to the weak side despite what they have done. Remember when we reported on a change up at the PBOC where they fired all their people and they brought in this FX expert in a attempt to save the yuan? And look at what's happened. They can't fight this. I have a really good slide here from another one from Jeff Schneider. If we go to the next slide, this is how he has it. So this is the inverse of what we just were looking at. And the red line is the actual exchange rate. The black line is what the PBOC, they set a rate at the beginning of every day for the market. Kind of like the gold price set, the bullion fix that goes on in London every day. They have a similar one here for their CNY versus the US dollar. They were trying to set it high. You can tell over the last couple months, they've been you know, setting it above the market rate in an attempt to pull that market rate up. It seemed to work a little bit, but now it has totally crashed off a cliff, and the PBOC is actually having to capitulate and go along with the downtrend. So this is market move. The CNY is getting weaker. So any comments on this before we get into some other stuff?
I was just trying to find my, I had a Wall Street Journal quote on this about how, you know, basically this threatens the entire system, and that they of course raised interest rates this week in China as a form of capitulation, right? To try to grease the wheels and get liquidity into the system, and it hasn't done anything, like completely ignored. And so the currency manipulation is not going to stop, is what I'm hearing. Like, they're going to keep trying more stuff, because what else can be done?
Yes. They've also cut rates, their interest rates.
Emergency. That's what I meant. Did I say they raised or they cut? Yeah. I meant to say they cut rates this week. Yeah.
Oh, I thought you said something about the exchange rate there, but yeah. You're right.
No. Pardon me. Yeah. I meant to say interest rates. That was something that happened this week, where there was a surprise interest rate cut this week.
Correct.
And it did nothing. Like, it hasn't given them any wiggle room or anything. No one, they're not fixing any of their problems.
Right.
And then shadow banking, of course, that's in trouble.
Yeah. There's a fine line there, because if you capitulate, if you're the central bank and you capitulate, that exposes you that you are so weak that you can't affect this market. You actually have to capitulate, because they said they weren't going to do it, and now they have to do it. But if they don't do it, they're totally screwed, because they lose complete confidence. So yeah, they're between a rock and a hard place over there in China, and the economy just, it continues into free fall here. If we go to the next slide, this is about the housing market. We'll actually get to the shadow banking that you just mentioned there. I have a story at the end, But this is the story out of Bloomberg, obviously. The China housing slump is much worse than official data shows. If we go to the next slide, that is declines in the price of housing. The official number is -6%, but private surveys, they have to go out there and do private surveys now in China. One thing you said at the beginning was nobody can trust these economic numbers and stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely true out of China. And so they have these private survey companies that go out and do this for a living, for a service. They actually try to prove these statistics wrong. And the private surveys are showing a -15% on average in most cities. Some are hit really badly down there at the bottom. Looks like about 25% crash in the price of housing. And that's bad because 70% of their household wealth is stored in real estate. If there is real estate cannot sell and the price is crashing, it's a very bad recipe for trying to move an economy away from an export-led economy towards more of a consumer economy. But you're taking all of your people's wealth away by crashing the real estate market. So any thoughts on the real estate market?
Yeah, I think it's even more intimate than just a financial sector in stress. The whole mandate of the Communist Party is financial success. So that was the headline. I found it here. And it's The Economist saying, how bad could China's property crisis get? Now, we don't believe anything that comes out of The Economist, right? So I'm not here saying that go read this edition of The Economist, right? Yeah. Don't do that, right? Don't do that to yourself. But I just want to share it because it fits my narrative, our narrative. So I'm just going to be biased and use it because it's being cherry-picked. But here's what Jonathan Cheng, he's the Chinese guy at the Wall Street Journal, commenting on the article in The Economist. So double fake news on top of what might be news. But here's what he says. He says, Country Garden's issue is one of over-leverage in the style of Evergrande. Is not over-leverage in the style of Evergrande, pardon me. Instead, it is a victim of a loss of confidence among regular folk and a sign that the government is losing control. So now, there's... You know, I bet you if you tomorrow went to China and crossed the country, you'd probably be hassled by less police than in America. You'd probably be, told to, you'd probably have an easier time as it is, right? But at the same time, their government and their people, we underestimate the capacity the Chinese people have, I think. To ignore their government and even revolt against them, as I understand, you could go to China today and you won't hear a lick of this social credit thing. This has a lot to do with our own propaganda and our own systems and The Economist and guess what they have in China, right?
Yeah.
Look, I'm not volunteering to go to China tomorrow by any stretch of the imagination, nor do I think if you went to China tomorrow, you'd have to use the social credit and the subway would turn off if you didn't say praise Mao, right?
Yeah.
Like that, I think, is as crazy as, now it's there. I'm sure some people are screwed. And again, I'm not trying to go there. But what I mean is they're it's not an insurmountable change and an insurmountable idea that big change could happen in China, just like big change can happen here. And, if it's true. And I believe for a long time that Xi has abandoned economic growth as a metric and has been trying to fill the void with chauvinism and Hollywood style stuff and movies and their own version of it. But it looks like anyway that they're in big trouble as far as the government. I think the people are going to be better off, but it looks like they're in real big trouble. And as you said, it looks like this could be the perfect scenario for Bitcoin, because remember, it's supposed to be China and their swing in Shanghai markets. They're going to get the BRICS2 shitcoin off the ground. And what I continue to predict is BRICS2 is going to be dead on arrival and everyone's going to be sitting there and they're all going to be saying, but we just told America we don't want to do business with them. What are we going to do? And there's Bitcoin waiting. So that I continue to believe is a plausible 2024 scenario. So I continue to cheer on the manipulators at the PBOC and the CCP. They are a big part of the accelerationist vision.
Yeah, just to touch on a couple of things you said there, the quality versus quantity growth. So that's what Xi is they're calling it quality, but really it's just we're trying to become a consumer-led nation and not be so reliant on exports. But yeah, they're going to end up crashing their car. And what I see is that it's less flexible than Western systems. Just like the Soviet Union, it's less, communism is just less flexible and will break before it kind of adapts, right? So that's
like you were saying, they only gave them real estate as a economic speculative outlet. Not that it's much better in America, not that it's much better.
Right? Yeah.
But it's the same idea, right? And that's why they're stuck with all, like as it looks to me, and I've only sort of looked into this, but the one they're talking about here, you know, this housing slump and the shadow bank guy who we're going to be talking about in a second, just to tee it up. I don't know how to pronounce the name of this shadow bank, so I'm not going to, but the group that we're talking about, you know, their behavior, it seems anyway, is more systemic than it was them just being like ambitiously corrupt or like, you know, it wasn't them trying to rob anyone. They're just doing what everyone in China has been forced to do, speculate hard on real estate and hope for the best, right? Because that's all you got.
Absolutely. Yeah. That, or, you know, like Foxconn, where you just get to a scale where they can have 100,000 workers on their campus, you know? So it's either like ghost cities.
Foxconn's Taiwanese though.
The Taiwanese, but they build their iPhones campuses, and stuff China. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, but kind of only business in town. It was speculating on real estate for a long, long time. And it's also culturally over there. Mm-hmm. Like, I guess before you get married, guys are supposed to have their life together and own a piece of property already and all this stuff. So it's cultural as well. But speaking of the shadow banks, let's get into this next story. So this is from Bloomberg again. Chinese shadow bank misses dozens of payments as fallout spreads. Zhang Rong, I guess that's how you pronounce it, International Trust, missed payments on dozens of products and has no immediate plan to make clients whole, indicating troubles at the embattled Chinese shadow bank are deeper than previously known. Wang Xiang, board secretary of the firm, partly owned by financial giant, another Z company that I can't pronounce, told investors in a meeting earlier this week that the firm missed payments on a batch of products on August 8th, adding to delays on at least 10 others since late July. According to people familiar with the matter, at least 30 products are now overdue, and Zhang Rong also halted redemptions on some short-term instruments, one of the people said. The company doesn't have any immediate plan to cover the payments since its short-term liquidity has suddenly dried up, Wang said. He added that the number of products with missed payments has risen, and the company is facing a tsunami of questions from investors and their own wealth managers. These wealth managers asked not to be identified because the meeting was private. Wang asked for patience as the firm seeks to recoup the value of its investments. The increased delays signal that the troubles at Zhang Jing, that's the parent company, I guess, which manages $138 billion. So not that huge, but it is one of these shadow banks. And like you said, it's systemic. So this is just one of many, are deeper than initially thought, as only three clients so far have publicly revealed missing payments by the two firms. Chinese authorities have already set up a task force to study any possible contagion. I'm sure that will work, with the banking regulator examining risks, people familiar with the matter said. So yeah, systemic. These people are missing payments, not just in the real estate sector, like the bonds from Evergrande and the bonds from Country Garden and stuff. Those are all going bad. But now it's these big trust companies that are big investment shadow bank type entities that are having problems. So Nolan, any comments on that?
Yeah, it continues to, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. I often will use that expression. And my only concern is how the collapse of the CCP goes down at this point, because we'll see if they could supplant economic growth with chauvinistic stuff, but I don't know if it's going to catch on there. And where does that really land them, right? Where are they really going to try to go to war? Do they have to now? Are they backed into a corner with Taiwan, right? I heard Vivek give the two of the best answers on Taiwan ever. First of all, Taiwan gets 2A, and that's all we need to ever do to defend them. Just give them straight up America, Second Amendment rights. Not only that, his answer that he gave this week is better than even answers I've heard, you know, any other candidate in the field give, which is America has a strategic interest in Taiwan. So right now it's non-negotiable. But once we displace microchips to our shores, it's negotiable. But that's the right answer. That has always been the right answer. So I don't even see there to be a reason for China. Well, what I mean to say is, if that's the discourse here, there's no incentive over there to even get hot on that level, right? Literally, all you have to do is America needs to make like some microchips, and then domestically, and you know, Taiwan is back to China.
Well, China would be funding the microchip factories here.
They sure would. Yeah, they sure would. They sure would. So all that said, right, there's a lot going on in China that we can't see. I worry about that, because if it is as bad as it could be, you know, the death pangs could be terrible, really the worst things we've ever seen. And if locking people in cages around their COVID thing, and if you remember last autumn, they did have some form of protest movement that began, and we don't really know what came of it. We don't really know how out of control it got. We don't even really know.
White paper stuff.
Yeah, we just don't know much, right? It's hard to tell these days. There's so much PSYOP stuff going around. But you gotta think that they're as close to systemic change as Americans are, and at least that the appetite is there.
Yes, and I'll go back to my last comment, is they're less flexible. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like? You know, America can kind of somewhat adapt to these sort of things.
Because of federalism and you know, like, you know, if you're in Texas or Florida, what do you care about what's happening in DC? Really? really? Yeah. You know,
there's at least some decentralization of power, but I think Taiwan is too risky for them. Mm-hmm. I think the chances that they invade Taiwan are higher now than they were, say, last year, 2 years ago, in my opinion, but it's still not all that high, because mm-hmm. it's just too risky. If they mm-hmm. look bad doing it, like let's say they lose half of their boats that are taking ferrying people over, that is going to be a humiliating disgrace mm-hmm. for the CCP. Even though they were successful, mm-hmm. if they didn't do it like easily, mm-hmm. it's going to be look bad for them. So I don't know. They're going to have to start something.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll send troops to Ukraine and put actual boots on the ground. Not just weapons, and you know, something like that, start some sort of proxy war.
I never even thought of that, Ansel. Don't say that. Don't mention that into existence. We don't need any more people in Ukraine. We've got enough there.
Well, eventually they're probably going to go into the stands, you know, like Tajikistan or something like that. I think they have bases in Afghanistan already, just mm-hmm. right on across the border. They have a very small border. It's only like a couple mm-hmm. kilometers, I think, but, they have a base right on the other side of that border. So they're already starting to move that direction, and maybe they'll do that instead of outright go in Taiwan and wait for US to build their chip factories. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It'd be a better idea. Right? It'd be a better idea. They got to keep playing the long game like they did with Hong Kong. They got Hong Kong back, right?
Yeah, and then they actually implemented got rid of the two systems, right? Way before.
No, it's finished. Yeah, there's no such thing as Hong Kong, whatever was there before is dead.
Yeah, but it was
a new thing, though. But you got to be excited about the new thing. I am. I'm going to give it a shot. I wouldn't have gone there. I'm still not dying to go or anything, but I'm open to it again. You know.
Well, wasn't it supposed to be like till 2050 that they had the two systems, you know, parallel, and then they went in early?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing's a travesty as far as I'm concerned, because the real old deal was that Victoria Island, which no one in Imperial China valued. It was garbage because there was no, it's not farmable, right? The actual island where the, not Kowloon, the central where Hong Kong and the skyscrapers and everything you see are, that was never like leased or anything. That was just British and common law existed there. It was a separate entity altogether. Mm-hmm. And it was to the point where the Chinese emperor laughed that they wanted it, that they wanted that bay. They said, what a bunch of idiots, right? Why didn't they take the island outside of Shanghai? They didn't understand. If you are shipbuilding, it's the second greatest natural port in the world after New York City. You can tell right away. It's deep water, protected on all sides by the mountain, and because it's a mountain, it's super defensible. Like if you know what a cannon is, you sit at the top and you go, well, you know, I'm the king of the castle, and so you can defend it very easily. You can't defend flat land very easily. So the whole thing is a travesty. None of it needed to be given back, really. It could have just stayed a free port and a free city without any oversight at all, right? Remember what the mayor who sold that country out had the greatest title in the world for a mayor before all this. It was the CEO. It was the CEO of Hong Kong. That's all I want is a CEO running my city. Is that too much to ask? That we have a chief executive officer running a city in the way that you would run a business? Like, is that so crazy, right? And it worked, but she was the one who sold them out for the enemies of Bitcoin, of course. I always mention it, for FATF and FinCEN and FinTrack and all of these people. That was the extradition law, right? It was because FinTrack said, oh, Hong Kong's a money laundering bastion because they don't allow Chinese law to be applied. That's what she cited, Carrie Lam, the CEO, the so-called sellout CEO of Hong Kong. One of the ultimate snakes of the downfall of the fiat system. She'll go down in the history books, this lady.
Now they are trying to get crypto or Bitcoin back into Hong Kong. Have you heard any updates on how that's going?
No, people are enthusiastic. I know from the event space, right? We were talking about some of that stuff. Of course, Bitcoin Amsterdam, October 12th and 13th in Amsterdam. So the idea is that people in Hong Kong have reached out to me on a number of levels now. It hasn't just been one or two. It's been a few saying, we want to get a show. We want to make Hong Kong a thing. We want people to come visit. That's why I mentioned I've even started thinking about going back. I went a lot in the early days and was a big fan of early days Hong Kong and Bitcoin. But most of the people there had to skedaddle. Because, you know, of course, SBF was there. SBF started in Hong Kong, right? That was before he scammed his way into the Bahamas. He was scamming in Hong Kong. So,
and he went back to jail this week.
Yeah, that's great. Huh? Isn't that fun? Yeah. Isn't that fun? And it was, did you see just how bad his parole like he went to jail because he broke the provisions of his parole, right? And he not only did he break them, he was like way overboard on all of them.
Oh, really?
It's crazy.
Yeah, I knew that he had, it had been revoked. Yeah, it had been revoked. But yeah, that's crazy. Anyway, let's wrap up this show, Nolan.
I just got to mention though, they put him in Epstein's jail, and Epstein, you know,
no way. In the same cell.
Say goodbye to SBF, guys. Say goodbye. You know.
All right, guys. Thanks for joining us. Like, comment, subscribe. Check out BitcoinandMarkets.com. Check out the breakup with Nolan. Don't forget Amsterdam and Nashville coming up next year. See you guys later. Bye.
What is up, audio listeners? Thank you for enjoying another episode of FedWatch. Down in the show notes, you will find all the appropriate links to our social media, the original version of this podcast, and community links. Also, check out bitcoinandmarkets.com, where I put out a free weekly newsletter every Friday, and there you can also help support the show by signing up to become a paid member. See you next time.
my fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history, held from October 12th to the 14th at Westergaas Event Forum, offering six different on-site locations and three fully programmed stages. We are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Lock yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.